This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, torture is as American as apple pie. Could George Bush and Dick Cheney become fugitives from international justice? And it looks like a new day for the Internet. But first, it was the biggest weekend yet for the new movement against police killing and abuse of Black Americans, with huge demonstrations in New York, Washington, and other cities. The D.C. demonstration was run by Reverend Al Sharpton, who also functions as a White House operative. Sharpton kept many of the young activists away from the microphones, but they tried to take the stage anyway. One of them is Erica Totten.
They came and spoke to try to calm us down and to tell us to go inside and go home and, you know, brought into the mainstream media message of people looting when that really was not the case. And so when they realized that we weren't going anywhere, that's when they stood up and realized that we aren't playing. This is a real revolution. This is a real movement. And so you want to be on the right side of history. So what they did was, you know, they used their platforms they had built for many, many years, being talking heads on MSNBC or whatever. They have a different platform than we do. And so I really wanted to see, we came with genuine intention to see who they would, whose voices they would elevate. And then when I saw that there wasn't anyone from Ferguson speaking, other than the parents, the people that had been out there protesting and the organizers weren't going to have a chance to speak, we kept being dismissed. And so I said, okay, stand behind me and follow me. We're going to shut it down like we always do.
That was youth activist Erica Totten, who was interviewed on The Real News Network. Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo is a veteran whistleblower and activist with the Hands Up Coalition in D.C. She says Al Sharpton works for the White House, not the people.
So the Obama administration has used a surrogate, and the surrogate is obviously Reverend Al Sharpton, to help corral that kind of energy and those kinds of issues back into the political system where those kinds of passions can die an unnatural death. And I think what we saw this morning was this young cadre of young leaders out of Ferguson saying, it's not going to be that way anymore. We know we've cried too much. Our sorrow is too deep. We've lost our brothers and our fathers.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. President Obama appointed former D.C. Police Chief Charles Ramsey to co-chair a task force on militarization of local police departments. But human rights lawyer Mara Verheiden Hilliard says Ramsey is the worst possible choice for the job. Her Partnership for Civil Justice Fund won millions of dollars in damages stemming from Chief Ramsey's mass arrests, infiltration and spying on protesters, dirty tricks by police agent provocateurs, and excessive use of tear gas and pepper spray. Verheiden Hilliard says Obama scraped the bottom of the barrel when he picked Ramsey.
We thought it would have been hard for President Obama to find a more inappropriate choice, given the fact that Charles Ramsey, when he was chief of police in Washington, D.C., was known for mass violations of civil rights, for implementing the militarized style of policing, for conducting mass false arrests of people engaged in First Amendment activity, for giving the green light to police officers to engage in brutality against demonstrators. And in the time that he was in Washington, D.C., as chief of police, our organization, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, filed multiple lawsuits against the District of Columbia to vindicate the civil rights of the people who were being victimized under his leadership. And ultimately, the city paid out more than $20 million based on the conduct that was occurring as he was commander. And more significantly, even, ultimately, through working with the D.C. Council and through the settlement agreements that we reached with the city, we were able to implement major reforms that were basically stripping the police of illegal tactics. But these are the very tactics that Chief Ramsey was authorizing and implementing.
You sound like what you're saying is that Chief Ramsey isn't even fit to be police chief of D.C. now that D.C. has a reformed kind of regime.
The only reason that we're seeing a difference in Washington, D.C. right now, and people are beginning to note this with the upsurge of the social movement in the streets against this tide of racist police killings, there have been people in the streets of Washington, D.C., just as has been all over the country, day and night since August. And the police in D.C. are treating the demonstrations completely differently than we're seeing in other cities. And that's not because the police are just nice. It's because there are major legal restrictions that have been put in place against the kind of conduct that we used to see under Chief Ramsey. But these didn't come about because Chief Ramsey, you know, saw the error of his ways. They came about because of major lawsuits forcing the D.C. police to comply with the Constitution and with just basic civil rights. So the idea that President Obama could select Chief Ramsey to lead a task force to look at policing in America and pretend that any reform is going to come from his leadership is ridiculous.
Well, what does this say about President Obama? Chief Ramsey, he's now chief of Philadelphia.
Well, chief of Philadelphia, there have been civil rights lawsuits, substantial ones, filed against the Chief Ramsey, Commissioner Ramsey in Philadelphia, including for their own version of stop and frisk, as well as for violations of demonstrators' rights. And it's clear that President Obama was looking for someone who was going to come out, who was going to talk nice to the press, who's going to use words and sound good and issue whatever inadequate, toothless reform document they ultimately will issue in about 90 days, but not that he was looking for anyone that was actually even going to pretend to create substantive change. And in fact, in the initial interviews with the announcement of the task force leadership itself is acknowledging that they really have no authority to do anything. They'll issue a report. This is just an effort to try and tamp down the outrage that is in the streets in America. And it's not going to succeed on that level either.
Well, if it's a meaningless commission, then maybe Chief Ramsey can't do too much harm.
He probably can't do any harm in that regard, but he can't do any good either. And the harm really is the pretense. The harm is having someone come out and act as if there is being a federal response to the militarization of police in America, when it's the federal government, the Justice Department, working with the Pentagon, that has been fueling our cities with billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars, $34 billion in grant money to buy military weaponry. And the militarization of the police that we see isn't merely just the weaponry. It's also the mindset of policing in America, which is really to look at the civilian population as if it's a military enemy. And once you do that, once you look at other humans as if they're a target, as if they're a military enemy, act as if your job is an occupation force, then our cities and towns become war zones. And people are just killed straight out on the street, like we've seen with Eric Garner, Michael Brown, but so many others whose names are not remembered every single day, but are more and more galvanizing the people in the United States who are demanding a change.
Back in June, 32 out of the 40 voting members of the Congressional Black Caucus supported the Pentagon's transfers of weapons and other military gear to local police departments.
Right. There's great support in Congress for this. There's a creation, in essence, of a sort of military-industrial policing complex. And the White House said, on the same day that they had their choreographed event to say that they were addressing policing in America, and then the same day they said that they had no intention of drawing back that kind of funding. They're not going to do that. But social change has never come in the United States because Congress or the White House suddenly benevolently decided to do the right thing, nor have changes where there is occasional change, like in D.C. with policing protests, that doesn't come because the police benevolently decide that they should follow the Constitution. It comes because there's a people's struggle, and a struggle that's in the streets and a struggle that's in the courts. So, in fact, I'm very hopeful now because we're seeing this real change in society in terms of what the demand of the people is, the awareness of this issue. And you're seeing people standing out in solidarity, in unison, demanding this kind of change. So however much gloss they try and put on it, and however much they try and sweep it under the rug by appointing people like Chief Ramsey to say, well, we're looking at it and we're going to handle it. People aren't going back in time.
That was Maura Verheiden-Hilliard speaking from Washington. At the University of Illinois in Champaign, Dr. Francis Boyle, a professor of international law, has been laboring for years to make it risky for Dick Cheney and other members of the Bush administration to travel abroad, lest they be arrested for their invasion of Iraq in 2003. Dr. Boyle says Bush and his men should be considered fugitives from justice.
I've already filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Gonzalez, Rice, and Tenet, and all their lawyer enablers like you, Bybee, Addington, Goldsmith, and the rest of them, for torture, war crimes, the enforced disappearance of human beings, and crimes against humanity. So right now what I'm doing is going through the Senate report, and I'll be making a supplementary submission to my pending complaint and demanding that the court move forward and open a criminal investigation. The significance of this report legally, Glenn, now factually, from what I've seen so far, all the facts have emerged into the public record except this rectal feeding, which is really rape. International criminal law has a definition of rape, and that's rape, and it's torture, it's rape torture, and a crime against humanity as well. But the facts are pretty well known already for those of us who've been involved in this and following us. But the significance of this report is that we now have a branch of the United States government making official findings of fact. As a legal matter, this is what we lawyers would call an admission against interest by the United States government. It can be used against the United States government itself in legal proceedings. It can be used against these individuals. Likewise, in United States courts, since it's an official government document, it is not hearsay, and it is also self-authenticating. Up until this point in time, all we've had are press accounts, and I don't mean at all to diminish the significance of what the press has done here in getting the story out on the torture. Now, the mainstream news media are complicit, as we've seen the New York Times and the Washington Post have facilitated the CIA. But the alternative media and investigative reporters have done yeoman service in trying to get as much of this story out. But the problem is, technically, legally, and I don't mean to diminish the significance of what they've done, press accounts are simply hearsay in court. So we need more, and now we have a lot more. Second, we will be using this to go after any of these individuals should they travel out of the United States. I've already scared Bush out of Switzerland for fear of prosecution. When he got word we were after him, he didn't go. I've gone after Bush three times now in Canada, but all three times those prosecutions, the proceedings were aborted by Prime Minister Harper, who's good friends with Bush. And I've also gone after Cheney once up there with, again, with Canadian lawyers. Center for Constitutional Rights is going after all of them in Spain right now. They had tried in Germany, but the German prosecutor copped out. So there are no statute of limitations for the commission of international crimes involved here, and these people can be pursued for the rest of their lives, just like, you know, we're still going after Nazi war criminals these days for what they did to the Jews, and rightly so. So that's the situation these individuals will be in. And then meanwhile, we'll continue our efforts to get them prosecuted here in the United States. So this is just the beginning, really, and we have a long, long way to go to hold these people accountable. But all the law, international criminal law, and United States domestic law is on our side, and the truth is on our side. But we really need the American people here to weigh in and demand that President Obama order the Department of Justice to appoint a special prosecutor to open a full-scale independent investigation leading to prosecution of everyone involved in this. That's what we need right now.
So in other words, the burden is now not on you or the Center for Constitutional Rights and others to prove these as allegations, because there have been admissions of guilt, or at the very least a branch of government that has made these charges on its own.
That's correct. And even Bush and Cheney have incriminated themselves. You see Cheney the last few days saying, look, we were briefed on these techniques. We knew what was going on. Bush has basically said the same thing. Indeed, if you read the Senate report, it all goes back to the Bush presidential order that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda should not be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. If they had been treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions, all this would not have happened. Obviously, there would have been isolated, small-scale abuses. That always happens in wartime, so okay. But not this massive policy of torture, sodomy, enforced disappearances of human beings, a crime against humanity, verging on genocide against Muslims and people of color. Right. Basically, you note all the victims here are Muslims, Arabs, Asians of color. So it verges on genocide. I'm not saying it is genocide, but it certainly is a crime against humanity. But it's really up to the American people. Look at, you know, all the African Americans now getting together all over the country with their supporters over Ferguson and Eric Garner and Cleveland. And it's going to take all the rest of us to demand that the government act, that the Obama administration act on this. You know, Obama was behind me at Harvard Law School. I've met him. He knows who I am. He knows what needs to be done here, and he's not doing it. And we need to build a fire under Obama. Yeah.
Most Americans don't know, and that's understandable, because American corporate media do not acknowledge that under the treaties to which the United States is a party, you can't just say, let bygones be bygones, look forward and not back, because the treaties require that there be punishment for these kinds of crimes of torture.
That's exactly correct, Glenn, but Obama knows better. And if you look at his statement this week, and then at the beginning under Holder when he first came in, that's what he's saying. But, you know, Obama's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He knows better. And he's simply not telling the truth out there. It's that simple.
What we hear coming from the CIA officials and from Obama administration officials, actually, is that these people were simply following orders, that is, everybody below the very top. But that is, of course, the Nazi Nuremberg defense.
That's exactly right. That's the defense the Nazis made at Nuremberg. I was just following orders right up the line to Hitler, and Hitler's dead, so no one can be held accountable. That defense was rejected by the Nuremberg Tribunal, which, by the way, was our idea going back to President Franklin Roosevelt. Stalin and Churchill didn't want a trial, just wanted to take them out and shoot them. But Roosevelt's idea was, no, we had to have a trial, give them due process of law. So that defense was made, and it was rejected. So I regret to say we're hearing some of the highest level officials of the land make Nazi defenses. To put it into historical perspective, you're certainly right, Glenn.
And of course, much of the political dialogue revolves around whether torture actually resulted in the divulging of information that saved American lives or not. But legally speaking, based on international law, that's irrelevant whether it worked or not. It's a crime.
That's correct, Glenn. The Convention Against Torture rules out torture under all circumstances. There is a federal anti-torture statute with no defenses except the normal defenses under U.S. criminal law. And even more so, the Geneva Conventions rule it out absolutely and completely. Torture during wartime is governed by the Geneva Conventions. It is absolutely prohibited. Even during wartime, which is how they drew up the Geneva Conventions to deal with a wartime situation. In fact, prior to 9/11 2001, the Pentagon itself drew up a manual for interrogation to be applied in actual wartime. We're not talking here about a bogus war against two-bit terrorists like Al-Qaeda. We're talking about a major conventional war. And in this field manual, and I've read it, I've testified to its contents in U.S. military court-martial proceedings, it completely rules out torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment as a matter of principle. And even the military interrogators signed off on that. The entire Pentagon signed off on it. First, as a matter of principle, and then second, as a matter of practicality, they know that this does not produce any useful intelligence information at all. It's simply a weapon of terror.
And last month in Geneva, the Obama administration, before a UN Committee Against Torture session, the Obama administration reiterated its current position that torture is inadmissible, improper, under all circumstances. Does that itself constitute a kind of admission of guilt that helps people like you in pursuing this legally?
Yes, it's another admission against interest against the United States government itself. Obviously, when President Obama came into office, he did sign this executive order against torture. So I'm not saying he himself is responsible for torture. But, you know, if he's not doing anything about it and he knows he has to, that can make him an accessory after the fact to torture. And that is really what we're dealing with here, is does Obama want to go down into history as an accessory after the fact to torture and war crimes?
And the statute not only calls for punishment, but it calls for compensation for people who have been tortured.
That's correct. And so far, the Obama administration has fought in court every effort by victims of torture to be compensated. You're exactly right on that, Glenn, which again raises the question of Obama and Holder being accessories after the fact to torture. Yes.
And then what about this whole classification of a certain group of people as enemy combatants and then falling under some other category or netherworld of law with these admissions? Is that whole category and therefore the justifications for treatment of this category of people nullified?
It's completely bogus, Glenn. Everyone in a time of armed conflict is covered by some provision of the Geneva Conventions. Indeed, I said that right at the beginning of this bogus, unlawful enemy combatant. And eventually, the United States Supreme Court itself agreed with me in the Hamdan decision, ruling that even Al-Qaeda and Taliban are protected by common Article 3 to the four Geneva Conventions of 1949, plus declaring someone not protected by any type of law, which is what Bush and his lawyer enablers tried to do, likewise violates the Hague regulations of 1907, to which the United States government is a party. So this is all propaganda. It's not black letter international law or U.S. domestic law, Glenn.
So what legal leg is there left to stand on, if there ever were?
They have none. I helped prosecute them all out in Kuala Lumpur, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld. If you're interested, you could hit their webpage, the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, prosecuting them and all their lawyers for torture, and won a unanimous conviction out there, which, you know, we have tried to get enforced elsewhere around the world. So they don't have a legal leg to stand on. That's right. And yet you see Berkeley Law School giving John Yoo a chair, giving a chair to a war criminal and a felon. It shows you how sick and demented Berkeley Law School has become, certainly when I started law school in 1971. And Harvard Law School, the dean there, Elena Kagan, now on the Supreme Court, deliberately going out and hiring a guy named Goldsmith who took Yoo's place and signed off on other torture memos. And it just shows you how sick and demented Harvard Law School has become, and legal education in general, where they go out and hire these torture lawyers. They tried to hire one here And I went ballistic and stopped it. And then, of course, I was censured by my dean for it. But she and her husband supported torture, not only here at the law school, but on this campus. It's a disgrace.
And this is not a legal question, but a political one. What kind of damage have the events of the last couple of weeks regarding the CIA report, what kind of damage has it done to U.S. standing in the world and their ability to preach to other folks about human rights and such?
Well, we're already seeing this. Cuba has said that. They're demanding investigations in Britain. North Korea has said this. I think we're going to see large numbers of states in the world, many of whom are dictatorships, saying you don't have a leg to stand on there, United States government, because you're not even prosecuting your own war criminals and torturers. So how can you lecture us on anything? You're total hypocrites.
Yes, and the United States and its allies, when they say that they have a responsibility to protect and therefore intervene militarily in other people's internal affairs, the underpinnings of that entire doctrine are weakened as well.
Well, that's always been a joke and a fraud, Glenn. We've discussed this before. I think my new book on destroying Libya and world order, I have a whole chapter going through that, demolishing the so-called responsibility to protect argument. We have a responsibility to protect here, a responsibility to prosecute our own torturers and war criminals. And yet, so far, we're not doing it.
That was Dr. Francis Boyle in Champaign, Illinois. America's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, says the CIA is guilty of every crime known to man. He files this report for Prison Radio.
In the wake of the Senate Intelligence Select Committee's report on CIA torture of terror suspects, we're reminded how little Americans know about how the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency rolls in the real world. Predictably, the 500-page summary of a 6,700-page report erupted into a political and media firestorm. Networks and cable news outlets are as happy as kittens on catnip. But truth be told, this ain't a new story. The CIA, the executive hand of the president, has been involved deeply in every crime known to man for decades. Journalist John Kelly, in an article published in the 2002 book, Into the Buzzsaw, cites a pretty interesting source for his revelation that the CIA commits literally hundreds of crimes a day and thousands per year. The source? The CIA itself. In his piece, Kelly cites a U.S. House Intelligence Committee staff report citing such crimes. They have overturned governments, launched assassinations, armed criminals to attack their governments, and were shocked that they tortured people? Seriously? Every president since the 1930s has been seduced by the lure of the CIA to make the world in their own image, sometimes by removing leaders they didn't like. Power like that is irresistible. And CIA, made immune by a law passed by Congress and signed by Bill Clinton on December 27, 2000, can violate any law, domestic or foreign, any treaty, or the Constitution itself with complete immunity and impunity, as long as they're following a presidential order. Is that deep or what? So, did they torture people? Yep. Did they kill people? Yep. Did they violate laws? Yep. But guess what? Under the Intelligence Authorization Act of 2001, they're immune from prosecution. That's American law, the law of the outlaw.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. The Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the CIA revealed that two psychologists were at the heart of the agency's torture program. Grayson Swigert and Hammond Dunbar were paid $80 million to help design and oversee CIA torture, according to Dr. Roy Idelson, a past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. Idelson recently wrote an article titled, "The Complicity of Psychologists in CIA Torture." We asked Dr. Idelson if the CIA psychologists reminded him of the infamous Nazi concentration camp doctor, Joseph Mengele.
Yeah, it's hard to compare different forms of torture. That was torture, this is torture, and this was absolutely a misuse of the healing profession and whatever skills one has as a result of being a doctor. I mean, foremost, there's the tremendous harm to the prisoners and their families. And then there's also the harm to the country and to the profession of psychology.
Well, I don't know what the Nazi doctor Mengele made from his atrocities, but these two psychologists made a great deal of money, and they seem to have sold the program to the CIA, convinced the CIA that this was the way to go.
Right. There's an $80 million number that's floating around, and that's what their firm, Mitchell Jessen and Associates, received with over just a period of a few years. Individually, I'm sure they got less than that, but they did not have the expertise to effectively and ethically interrogate prisoners. The CIA was looking for more aggressive methods because they seemingly weren't getting the information they wanted, and there was pressure from, I imagine, the very top, in the White House, to get some information from these people. It wasn't useful information. It wasn't happening. And the CIA was persuaded that this idea of reverse engineering, SEER training, and using theories of learned helplessness to kind of debilitate detainees could be effective. And it was torture from the beginning, but there were legal workarounds that the Bush administration used so that it could be presented as not being torture.
We usually hear of medical personnel being on the scene in torture situations in order to make sure that the victim of the torture's life or mental health is not irredeemably impaired. But even that doesn't seem to be the function of these two.
That absolutely was not their function. They designed the torture techniques, and in some cases, they implemented them. The perversion of what you're describing is that through the Office of Legal Counsel, if you remember back in 2002, so John Yoo and others, the Bush administration redefined what torture is, and in a specific way that created the importance of health professionals. Because what they did was they essentially said that the presence of a psychologist was prima facie evidence that a detainee was not being tortured, because, in a sense, the helping professions would not participate in torture. And so if a psychologist was in the interrogation room or observing, he or she would call an end to the interrogation when it was felt that it had reached or gone over a threshold that would constitute torture, such as permanent mental or physical harm. So that was built into the system through the Office of Legal Counsel memos. And in fact, there's a 2005 memo from OLC to the CIA approving the use of waterboarding if a psychologist is present at all times. So the idea that of psychologist as safety officer, which is what has been promoted and what the American Psychological Association promoted, kind of loses all useful meaning if it allows something like waterboarding to go on. But in fact, that was basic. Psychologists needed to be present in order to waterboard someone.
You speak of the damage done to the psychological profession. How closely associated with these practices has the American Psychological Association or its key members become?
There's evidence the APA colluded with the CIA, the Department of Defense, and the White House to adjust its ethics policy for psychologists so that psychologists could consult and participate in these interrogations and detention operations. If the APA had not done that, then the government would have faced a difficult prospect. The American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, so both the physicians and psychiatrists, had around 2006 decided this is not okay, our members should not be participating or involved in interrogations in any way. So that left only the American Psychological Association as the group, the major health group, that said, we support this. We support our members being involved. And had the APA at that time also taken a different course, the same course as the others, the government would have been in a situation where all of the major health professions were refusing to collaborate. And especially given that the legal counsel memos made specific reference to the role of health professionals, that would have been a tough situation, because if there were no health professionals involved, then there was no way to ensure that torture didn't take place.
Presumably these two psychologists didn't carry out waterboarding or any of the other variations of torture, but do you consider them to be as fully culpable as those who carried out the physical torture?
Yes, I would consider them fully culpable, but also they did, in fact, conduct some of the waterboarding sessions themselves. According to the Senate report, Mitchell and Jessen were directly involved in the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah in 2002, and I think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed later than that. So they would be equally culpable had they just devised the program, provided guidance on how to waterboard well, and other such things. But at the same time, the facts are, apparently, that they were directly involved. Pouring the water, for instance.
And what do you expect to come out of this from the American Psychological Association?
I think there needs to be full transparency in terms of what actually happened in the years post 9/11, what decisions did the APA make in regard to involvement with the military and intelligence community, who made those decisions and on what basis. So that kind of transparency that has been hidden for over a decade now, we need that. Based on that, we need accountability in terms of APA staff and leadership and anyone else who may have been involved, if there's evidence that there was collusion, you know, inappropriate collusion and corruption within the APA, then those who were involved with that need to be held accountable. The association should not go forward with those same people in those positions of leadership and influence if the evidence points toward collusion.
So if all these facts are true, you'd like a purge of the American Psychological Association to rid it of the taint of torture.
I would like those who are responsible to be removed from their positions, yes. But in addition to transparency and accountability, I think there absolutely needs to be reform. There needs to be some change in the way the APA does business, and especially does business with the government and with the military and the CIA, so that these situations and these kind of travesties of ethics do not arise the next time.
Polls show that about 50% of the American public favors torture in one way or the other. That might apply to 50% of psychologists as well.
Well, you know, I've wondered about that. I'm afraid to know what those numbers might be in my profession. I'm not at all sure that they're very different from the ones you quote. And the ones you cite are obviously very disturbing, and they have not changed from what I can tell. I mean, that for over a decade, they have stayed right around 50%, and in some cases higher. In part, I believe that's based on the assumption that these people being tortured have done terrible things or no crucial information to prevent terrible things. That doesn't in and of itself justify torture anyway, especially since it's ineffective. But a lot of the people that were mistreated had done nothing wrong. I mean, that's how you end up with teenagers at Guantanamo. There were people swept up off the battlefields in Afghanistan. They had no connection to Al-Qaeda. So a lot of the abuse, bad enough that we treat prisoners who have done something wrong that way, but a lot of the abuse was taken out against, from what we know or can tell, innocent individuals, and none of them were ever found guilty. It's tough. The 50% number, that many Americans are comfortable or support torture, makes it harder to eliminate torture as an option. It kind of cuts into the resistance, the public outrage. And you can see it even now in some of the responses to the Senate report, that there are those who clearly are defending what was done as having been necessary.
Well, maybe one great psychologist project would be to look into the American mentality and worldview that generates those kinds of poll numbers.
That would be a great project. It would be very worthwhile. I think the numbers, differ country by country. And in part, it's hard to know where our numbers, why they are, what they are, but quite possibly they're related to the propaganda that we're subjected to as a nation immediately after 9/11, a lot of which was an effort or had the consequence of dehumanizing others, dehumanizing those we considered the enemy. And when you dehumanize people, that's a psychological process, and it makes it a lot easier to mistreat them when you consider them less than human. There were people at the top who were talking about needing to drain the swamp, smoke them out of their holes. These are metaphors that, among other things, communicate that we're dealing with animals, not human beings.
Dr. Roy Idelson of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. The U.S. Justice Department has filed papers certifying that former President George Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and other Bush administration officials should be immune from prosecution for invading Iraq in 2003 because they were simply acting within the scope of their employment as federal officials. But California attorney Inder Komar says the conspiracy to invade Iraq began years before George Bush and his men took over the White House.
We've alleged that at least two members of the administration, Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, who was Undersecretary of Defense at the time in the Bush administration, we allege that as early as 1997, these people were very vocal, calling for the military invasion of Iraq and the overthrow of the Hussein government. That's very important because it establishes pre-administration conduct, pre-administration intent, that once we come into power, this is what we're going to do. And so then you fast forward to the election, and you fast forward to the first week of office, and we cite to Paul O'Neill, who is the former Secretary of the Treasury under Bush. He was his first Secretary of the Treasury. And in the first national security meeting, he describes in his book basically a scripted exchange where everyone's talking about, well, when are we going to go and invade Iraq now? How are we going to deal with this issue? And he couldn't believe it, that the first week of office they were already talking about that. Then you fast forward to 9/11, and there's a lot of evidence that we cite, too, that shows that on 9/11, the administration was talking about, this is our opportunity now to invade Iraq, even though people who heard that were shocked because, obviously, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, but they were going to use it as a cover to now implement this plan that they wanted to do. And so then, after 9/11, we cite to all the statements the administration made where they conflated the Hussein regime with Al-Qaeda. They said they were the same thing when they're not. When they talked about this alleged threat of weapons of mass destruction, which we know never existed. And then they failed to get United Nations approval. So, under international law, war has to be conducted only in self-defense or when it's authorized by the United Nations. And the Iraq War was not a war of self-defense, and it was not authorized by the United Nations. And so when they actually invaded Iraq, that completed what's called the crime of aggression, which is the supreme international crime as defined by the Nuremberg Tribunal in 1946. So Nuremberg is becoming very relevant today for so many reasons. You know, Nuremberg gave us this legacy of war crimes, which are now everyone's talking about because of the Senate torture report. You know, the key laws about torture came from Nuremberg. Nuremberg gave us this legacy of genocide and the crimes against humanity. Those came from Nuremberg. But interestingly enough, what Nuremberg called the supreme crime was engaging in wars of aggression. Because if you never commit the wars, you'd never do the war crimes and you'd never commit crimes against humanity. And so that's what my client is alleging in the complaint, is that the conduct and the activity amounts to aggression under international law.
And not only that, but that the conspiracy predates their activities as officials of the U.S. government.
Well, that's exactly right, yeah. So if it predates it, then how could this be done within the scope of one's employment, right? I mean, that's the whole point. It's so interesting. This case is going to hinge on District of Columbia employment law, right? So, you know, the court will literally be looking at employment cases in terms of what counts as acting within the scope of your employment. And we make the argument that if you take a job somewhere with a pre-existing intent to commit a crime, you can't blame the employer for that, right? And so similarly, it's documented pre-existing intent, talking about once we come into power, we're going to overthrow Saddam. And once they came into power, that's exactly what happened. So we're arguing that that can never be within the scope of a government duty, government official employment. And I mean, the facts are just so egregious. It's very rare to have a situation, I think, where government officials who, before coming into office, have been so vocally militant. And I think that's what makes this case a good case to test this theory, because the facts are frankly so awful. And I think we should be debating whether Obama's actions currently in Syria are legal or illegal or not. But Obama never said on a campaign trail that he wanted to target Syria. Actually, I think he said the opposite. But this is not the case with members of the Bush administration. You know, before they came to office, they were very vocal about this agenda. And so I think that that's what's critical. Now, and actually a second point we're making is we actually cite to the Pinochet case, too. And the Pinochet case is a case that came down in 1997 in the United Kingdom. Pinochet was a former dictator of Chile, and he was in the United Kingdom when he received a warrant from a Spanish judge for his arrest for torture. And he argued that everything he did was in the lawful scope of his employment. But the House of Lords in London rejected that argument. And they said, you know, your country is a party to the Convention Against Torture. Your country has forbidden torture. So you don't get to use the for my country defense. You know, you didn't do this for your country because your country prohibits this conduct. And so we made it the exact same argument to this court, which is that the United States signed the Nuremberg Charter. You know, the United States set up these treaties to prosecute war criminals after World War II. So as a matter of national policy, we've forbidden aggression. So anytime someone commits aggression, it can't do in the scope of their authority. We're relying actually quite heavily on the Pinochet precedent, which has sat there now for more than 10 years, and people have seemingly forgotten it. But it's easy to forget, but in the late 90s, there was this real big push towards government accountability of leaders, and that all went away after 9/11. You know, we were really on a good path, I think, from an international law perspective before 9/11, and 9/11 kind of changed everything.
And President Obama, whose Department of Justice has taken these steps to, they hope, protect Cheney and the rest, Obama calls it a dumb war, but he does not, of course, admit that it was an illegal war.
That's exactly right. And that's the exact same position he's taking with the torture. You know, he calls the torture wrong, but he's refusing to prosecute. He says the war was wrong, but he's refusing to investigate or prosecute. And I think at some point, people have to really push back on that, really push back on that, because saying something is wrong but not prosecuting it is essentially condoning it. And if we're going to go after people like Edward Snowden for breaking laws who are revealing wrongdoing, it's extremely hypocritical and frankly, I think, indefensible to not conduct a similar investigation when it's the people committing crimes on the other side.
Attorney Inder Kumar in San Francisco. Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific historian and professor of African American studies at the University of Houston, says torture is as American as apple pie. Dr. Horn spoke to Eutrice Lead on the Progressive Radio Network.
I do think that this report in many ways exposes and betrays many of the structural weaknesses that we have in the United States of America, not only in terms of the ruling elite and their resort to torture, but also in our response to it. Because we now have on our agenda cases of torture abroad and torture at home, because we know that the parents of Michael Brown, the slain Ferguson, Missouri teenager, went to Geneva a few weeks ago to testify before the United Nations in Geneva on the question of torture. We also know that a number of individuals from Chicago went to Geneva as well because of well-documented cases of the Chicago police torturing black men in particular. And yet, these two parallel obscenities are proceeding on separate tracks. There are few in the Ferguson and police violence movement who will be able to speak sadly and tragically to the question of what's happening abroad. And likewise, there are few in the movement abroad who focus on the movement abroad here at home who will be able to speak intelligently about Ferguson. Although in Karachi, Pakistan, you had a massive demonstration where not only was the United States condemned for the torture report that the Senate just released, but also they were carrying pictures of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. In other words, our friends abroad are able to make these linkages, but unfortunately and tragically, oftentimes those sorts of linkages are not made at home. We also know that with regard to this torture report, we also saw how in the United States there is this very outrageous fascination with rape of men. We saw that the same tactic used against Abner Louima, a Haitian man in Brooklyn some years ago by the New York police authorities, where they basically took a stick and, shall we say, jammed it into his rectum. Similar tactics are documented in the torture report released by the U.S. Senate. We also know, and let me step back for a second and say one of my favorite left-wing listservs sent out a comment saying that the so-called founding fathers would have objected to torture. And yet, this very intelligent writer did not seem to realize that recent studies on slavery suggest that the slave owners in the United States honed methods of torture against enslaved Africans to increase productivity and profit. That is to say, those who are yammering all over the airwaves about this is not us when it comes to torture, that is to say, this is contrary to so-called U.S. values, really don't know beans about U.S. history, because this used to be the torture empire of the world, with enslaved Africans being a major victim.
Dr. Gerald Horn's new book is titled Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. President Obama surprised a lot of people when he recently endorsed some form of internet neutrality, in which the Federal Communications Commission would regulate the internet like a public utility. However, the Democratic chairman of the FCC, Tim Wheeler, has mainly sided with the giant telecom corporations. Kevin Zeese has been leading protests at the FCC, demanding internet neutrality. He says the FCC should never give up its power to control the fees charged by internet corporations.
Cable companies are going through a big shift right now. A lot of networks like HBO and CBS are moving off of cable into their own independent subscription where people can watch it on the internet. And so that's going to really undermine the whole cable control of TV. And so they're going to be looking for more money. We're going to want to make sure that they don't take it out of people who just want to get onto the internet and participate in the 21st century commons of free speech.
And my understanding was that President Obama's position was that the FCC should not get into regulating rates, dealing with prices.
Well, he hasn't gotten that specific, but they all do. They all like this language of light touch regulation. You know, they always. This is such an anti-regulation government, both the Democrats and Republicans. So that will be a battle to push to make sure they actually use the regulatory power they have to create an internet that works for us all. So there are still battles ahead. But Obama really went about as far as we expected him to go, even further than I expected him to go, actually, in his statement, which was pretty much what we wanted to hear.
Forgive me for my cynicism. Obama did appoint Tim Wheeler, who was the industry lobbyist and who has been opposing internet neutrality. So you don't think that we're actually looking at good cop, bad cop, and Obama getting to preserve his legacy, but Wheeler continues to do the dirty work for the telecoms?
I think your cynicism is not misplaced. We worry about that as well. This is a way for Obama to say the right thing and for Wheeler to do the wrong thing. That is why we continue to put the pressure on, and I think we're having a major impact. It's amazing how far we've come and pushed Wheeler in our direction. People are now reporting that some kind of reclassification is inevitable. That's what the trade associations, that's what the publications that cover the FCC, you know, for the trade associations are saying, that some kind of reclassification is inevitable. The question is, what kind? And so we have to keep fighting for that. The telecoms are very upset by this. They are working very hard. They're putting out all this false information.
The telecoms don't just put out massive disinformation. They put out massive, massive amounts of money in campaign contributions and subsidies for the so-called traditional civil rights organizations. And those organizations and much of the Congressional Black Caucus, in fact, since 2005, much of the Congressional Black Caucus has been in the telecoms pockets.
Oh, my God. It's really ugly to watch the civil rights community, at least the traditional old civil rights community, people like the NAACP and the Rainbow Push Coalition, people like the Black Caucus that you mentioned, they are so deep in the pockets of AT&T and other telecoms that they do their bidding and have always done their bidding, whether it's mergers or net neutrality. They're taking the wrong position, despite what's obviously best for the African-American and any community that's mistreated in the society, has no access to the media. Those communities in particular need to have net neutrality so they can have access to the media, create their own media, reach out to their constituencies and organize people for, you know, mobilizations that are necessary and a whole host of issues. So, yeah, the misleadership of that community has been raised at this point. But there's a lot of new advocates for civil rights and for African Americans and Latinos who are taking quite the opposite position. And in fact, there was a letter signed by over 90 new organizations in those areas who came out in favor of reclassification and net neutrality. So this is really pulling out the divide between the misleaders in that community and those who are really trying to do best for what that community needs.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.